Hello and welcome to another edition of Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. My name is Kurt Holman, and I write about movies for Creative Loafing in Atlanta. And with me are my co-hosts.
I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com.
And we have a couple of films to talk about today, but the primary one, the one that, of course, is he who cannot not be named, is Harry Potter and Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. So who wants to kick off on talking about Deathly Hallows Part 1?
I'll go for it. So when we last left Harry, he is resolved not to return to Hogwarts. Instead, he's on a mission to find these magical items known as Horcruxes, which contain pieces of his nemesis's soul, Voldemort. Voldemort, in an effort to remain immortal, has broken his soul into seven items. They've destroyed two of them so far, and the search is on for the other five. And so with him, as always, are Ron and Hermione. Unfortunately, Voldemort is now gaining far more power. Dumbledore is gone, so Harry's protector is no longer around. And the wizarding world is basically at war, the war that has been building since the fourth movie. We've now seen that come to fruition. The police state is rising. And
very Reich-like.
Oh, yes.
On film.
It's funny. I mean, and because parts
leather jackets and all.
Yeah.
Because parts of the film feel like an a World War II resistance movie.
Yeah.
I was calling it Inglorious Wizards, and I mentioned it on my Facebook thing, and a guy I know says, I never thought of Voldemort as a fascist before, and it's like, I mean, he's this huge totalitarian guy with this, you know,
pure blood ideology.
So maybe he was being sarcastic, but, but those things are all done very powerful in terms of, like, metaphorical theme, and also cleverly in terms of, like, when Voldemort takes over the wizarding world and the Ministry of Magic becomes this tool of oppression, you see, like, these, like, propaganda machines about, like, the Muggle menace, and it's, like, Red Scare pamphlets from, like, the 1950s. And
somewhere
like
between
that.
Nazi Germany and J. Jonah Jameson's Daily Bugle updates about how Spider-Man is evil.
Right.
Anyway, Matt, carry on.
Really, that's it. That's the plot. Because a lot of it is just then the characters wandering about, sort of not, they have a goal, but they have no idea how to achieve it. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult film because it, you know, they're no longer in Hogwarts. There's no longer, you know, fun with magic classes and look at these fantastical creatures. This is three people on the run for their lives while trying to achieve a goal. They have no idea where to start and just sort of, you know, grasping at straws. And meanwhile, their friendship is being put to the test as, you know, they've been forced to leave their families and they're on their own. And it's very, it's a not subtle metaphor about leaving the structure of school and that safety that that provides and trying to find your place in the world. It's just also in the backdrop of war as well.
Yeah, some people have complained a little bit about this film. And one of the complaints they applied toward the book was that there's this part where they're on the run and they're basically camping, you know, and depressed and kind of in this sort of bummer state for a long stretch. And the movie itself kind of slows down. And I kind of like that. I like this sort of gloomy vibe hanging over them. And there's a neat sequence where they're like walking a lot and you – and Ron Weasley, one of Harry's best friend, is like listening to news of, like, you know, the wizarding world on this, you know, old-fashioned radio. So there's this staticky, murmuring radio, and it feels almost like a film from like the 60s or an earlier decade. And I really thought that was cool. But I know that some people didn't like that part as much. I was wondering if y'all had feelings about
it. I'm very much with you. I like that a lot. And that tone, that overall feel is what I liked about this movie a lot in general. It's a very... It's you know, everything ends, and this movie is very much the beginning of the end, and it's a melancholy movie. It's kind of a dire movie. I mean, very much with what Matt was saying, it's a movie about uncertainty, and it is. It's interesting because it's a mainstream tentpole pseudo action effects film in which nobody knows what to do.
Yeah,
you know, none of the characters know what to do next, and. For me, the appeal of the Harry Potter movies, looking back at them, has been, I mean, it's, this is a, it's a very unusual set of films to come out of a major studio and to be this giant blockbuster thing, because we've been watching these kids grow up, and we're watching the actors grow, we're watching the characters grow, and taken as an aggregate, it's really pretty effective in chronicling sort of, you know, the development of their lives, and this is a very natural, necessary step in that, and I think it's handled very well here. I think David Yates does some great storytelling where he and the screenwriters don't overburden the film with dialogue. They really do a lot of kind of very pure cinematic storytelling where it's all visual, it's done through sound and music and the image, and it's a beautifully shot film. There's a lot of stuff that's just communicated by the core trio of actors who by now work very, very well together and have really developed their own takes on the characters. And I responded to that really well. I liked that, and the parts where the movie kind of breaks open into more action and more lively stuff were very welcome. But I really liked those aspects, you know, the long stretches where not much was happening, because for me, it's something that I think we need to see in this series. And it's nice to see it break free of Hogwarts. It's nice to see it break free of this pattern of, oh, there's a mystery and a trinket or a creature plot. Yeah, I mean, it's completely moved away from that structure that was in the first three or four movies, and it's become something that feels more organic. And maybe it's emblematic. Maybe it says a lot about the fact that there's a scene in the middle of the film that's, I guess, is controversial to fans of the books, because it's a scene that isn't in the books anywhere where Harry and Hermione have this moment where they kind of almost confront the question of whether there's any romantic interest between them. You know, she's been dating Ron, and Ron is kind of bugged out by what's going on. He disappears for a minute, and Harry and Hermione have this little interlude, and it's set to the song "O Children" by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which is playing on that radio that you mentioned that Ron has been listening to. And in this little scene feels like it's, I guess I liked it because it feels like it's born out of the movies rather than out of the books. It's born out of the relationship between, you know, the characters that have been created on screen. And it felt like something, again, that we needed to see. But it's not dialogue heavy. It's just them physically around each other.
And it's a lovely grace note that kind of doesn't go in kind of a hot and heavy direction, but in a way that feels touching and emotional at the same time.
I agree. Well, what impressed me about the film, one of the things that impressed me is that it has a lot of tones. It has some great jokes in it. It also has these thrilling action chases, scenes that could be like out of a horror film. And then you also have these slow, quiet moments. And I was just really impressed at how well it all gets juggled. And I know some may have trouble with those, with the shifts, but I think they were handled wonderfully.
I don't think any of us, I feel saying, don't have any trouble with that. And I will say, in the early films, like the comedy about the magic was never my favorite thing, and I've seldom thought that it came across very well. Even some of the jokes in like Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which I think is generally wonderful, and it's like, but the kind of the eat slugs Malfoy, and you know, oh, it's magic and we're gonna prank the Dursleys now, but the magic jokes in this, since they break the tension, feel so welcome, and it's like, oh, this reminds me of those films that I may not like as much, but it you know, evokes like this kind of nicer time in the midst of all this, you know, serious angsty struggle. So, you know.
Yeah, and it's the action stuff works really well. I mean, there's an early chase scene that also incorporates a bit of that magical humor, and that works really well. And I completely agree with you, Matt. I think the tonal shifts are great. The one thing I will say is I've not read the books at this point. I read the first few Potter books, and I went into watching this movie not even really remembering all the details about the Horcruxes and why they were important and what exactly they are, and I didn't have any problem with that aspect of the film. I was like, okay, they're MacGuffins, it's fine. I've got to find these things, and the specifics will be revealed, and I'm not going to worry too much about it. But there are two points right at the end of the film, and this is part of where the fact that they've broken this one big story up into two films doesn't do a great service to this particular movie is right at the end there are two things that feel very much like Deus Ex Machinas to me. Mm-hmm. These two things that happen, and one of them is motivated, I think, and maybe feels more motivated to those who've read the books, and another one, I think, from what I've talked to people, you know, who've read the books, they were like, in the books it seemed kind of perfunctory too. Mm-hmm. And it sort of almost broke the spell that the movie had me in up to that mm-hmm. point, because suddenly it was just like, oh, right, plot mechanisms, we need to get back to this, and this stuff has to happen, and maybe we can do a spoiler bit and I can, you know, talk exactly
about what
I'm
speaking of. We'll save that for a little bit later.
But that was those were the bits, you know, there are two bits at the end where I was sort of like, not so much.
I've like read all the books and was a big fan of the books, and I was like one of the people who got his copy of Deathly Hallows on the Saturday that it was published.
Me too.
And read it basically in two sittings, like that day and the next morning. Right. You know.
See, I went to Target and read the end.
Okay, there you go. There you go. Yeah. And but even so, like, this movie has so many magical MacGuffins and objects, because, like, mm-hmm. they're the Horcruxes, one of which we know basically what it is, and the others we don't know. Dumbledore, in his will, leaves them some objects, and the Deathly Hallows refers to objects, and Voldemort's after his own object, and Harry Potter's holding this chunk of what's probably that mirror from the movies, but I don't even remember how he got it. It's like,
yeah, I didn't remember what.
Yeah. I can barely keep track of all these things,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
So that seemed a bit much, and it kind of amazes me that those aspects of the movies, people are like, you know, this is pretty clunky at times because there's just so much of this that they don't streamline, you know. So if you see it, you should watch, like, you know, the last movie, like, right beforehand, because it doesn't, like, offer very much of a recap.
And I kind
of
like that. Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, this is part seven. I mean, if you were to, like, right. open up a book to chapter seven, like, seven-eighths of the way through, and it's like, I don't understand what's going on. Well, why did you start the book there?
Right.
It's, I mean, all the first six films are available, mm-hmm. and I don't understand why someone would just jump in mm-hmm. to be like, I'm going to go see the seventh Harry Potter movie. Have you seen all of them? No, but now's a good time to get interested,
right.
I suppose.
Right. I'm at the ball. It's the next one starting. So.
Right. Yeah. I'll be the guy at the theater who keeps asking questions nonstop to the right. person I'm with. What's that? What's that?
Yeah.
Who's that? No, just there's six films all available.
And some of those issues and some of the people talking about the particular pacing of this movie to me are reminiscent of complaints about the six endings at the end of Return of the King. And I'm like, well, you know, the ending of Return of the King isn't the end of that three-hour movie. Mm. It's the end of one 10-hour movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and in the same way, this is a standalone movie, but only because it has to be. That's kind of a technicality. And you do need to look at it as this is several beats that are at the end of a much longer saga. And if you look at it like that, everything does kind of fall into place. That chunk of mirror that you're talking about plays right into one of the Deus Ex Machina things that bugged me. And the mirror, again, I was like, I don't really know what that is. But it's, you know, it seemed to be performing a pretty obvious function. And I was like, okay, I'm willing to work with this. I figure that when it's important that I know what's going on here, the movie will tell me what's going on and why it's important. And, you know, you mentioned the Deathly Hallows of the title. I didn't even know what the Deathly Hallows were when I went into this. And fortunately, there's a really wonderful little animated sequence that explains
that. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
And there's a point in the book there's a point in the film, in both, I suppose, where the Deathly Hallows are explained and there are three objects, et cetera. And in the film, it breaks into this little kind of very stylishly animated interlude that's kind of a little film within the film. Mm-hmm. It's a fable being told. And I really liked it. I thought it was really a nice little
if they could nominate
tactic.
Like portions of other films as best animated short, that should get it.
Yeah, it's a really nice little piece of film.
Yeah. One thing about kind of like where the ending of this film comes, not plot-wise, but in kind of the nature of the ending, is that in other films, they're like multi-part films, like filmed all together. Mm-hmm. The one of the kind of the transitional parts will end with like a great big scene and right. then kind of send you out to the next one. Or there'll be a big scene and a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And this one ends basically at a chapter break. So it's like da-da-da-da-da and end and credits. Yeah. It's like,
it's kind of an intermission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel... You know, but it ends up kind of sending you out and kind of feeling kind of down almost. It's like,
the Empire
well,
Strikes
gee,
Back ending.
Yeah.
Which is
it's,
actually
you know,
refreshing for the Harry Potter series because
is,
every
yeah.
movie in the Harry Potter series, no matter how dark it gets, mm-hmm. almost all, I think all of them end with like them looking wistfully out over the ocean like
right.
next to Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Like, right. Everything will be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like people just died. It's
right.
like, no, I think, if, you know, it's just
yeah.
they like looking out onto the vista
yeah.
of a new tomorrow. It feels like, and to the point where like at the end of Order of the Phoenix, mm-hmm. where that it feels the film can get very dark at times. And mm-hmm. then at the end, it's like, yes, even though the whole series is building to a giant cataclysmic war is coming,
mm-hmm. right.
not everyone will make it out alive. Pretty vista.
Yeah.
yeah. No, I mean, this is going expecting the ending of The Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
That's what
yeah.
this is.
Yeah.
It's like Vader's Luke's father. He cut off his hand. Mm-hmm. The Empire is ascending in power.
Mm-hmm.
Boba Fett's got, you know,
yeah.
Han Solo. And we don't really know what's going to happen
mm-hmm.
next. And that's this movie as well. You know,
yeah.
it's very, very similar.
Right. What are y'all's favorites in the film? Not obviously, obviously the last one comes out in July. Do y'all have favorites? Yeah.
For me, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen each of them once. Mm-hmm. And... the first couple of the Chris Columbus ones didn't do very much for me. Mm-hmm. They're much more kids' movies. And as they've gone, I've liked them. I generally like the third, fourth, and fifth
mm-hmm.
Quite a bit for each one for a little bit different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is quite possibly my favorite of them now.
Mm-hmm.
I like six the best. I mean, this one I mm-hmm. respect the most simply because it's, I think, the most challenging. It has the most difficult task to pull off. But I just like the emotional range of
mm-hmm.
six. Six is... my least favorite of the books,
mm-hmm.
but the way it was compacted into one film, and it really is like, this is the last hurrah of our time at Hogwarts. You know, this is sort of a culmination that you couldn't get to
mm-hmm.
if you hadn't made five films before that increased in quality.
Yeah.
So to me, what I like about six is that you can't really get six without the first five. It doesn't really
mm-hmm.
stand alone, but it feels very rewarding as a film that's like, man, it's just, I'm so glad this series has developed. It just makes me happy. I
yeah,
really like
yeah.
six, even though it's definitely got its own darkness. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, characters that were previously relegated to like more comic relief get a time get a chance to shine, and it just shows that everything is constantly developing and that the series never tried to rest on its laurels and
mm-hmm.
keeps moving forward.
Yeah, my favorite is deferring the possibility of considering Deathly Hallows 1 and 2 as one film that could be my favorite is the fifth one, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which is the first one that
David Yates
directed, and partly because it hangs together so well as kind of a youthful rebellion,
mm-hmm.
kind of like Lindsay Anderson's If,
yeah.
you know, a boarding school movie, you know,
yeah.
in a magic school.
Right.
I think it holds together so well and is so consistent all the way through. And I the sense of like the kids coming together and learning things and, you know, just the whole Dumbledore's Army training stuff with them.
That stuff,
I just love that stuff so much
yeah.
in that movie, you know. It was like one of my favorite top 10 movies of that year. I don't know if this one will be one of my top 10s, even though I like it very much, you know, but it's kind of the ones where, since it feels inconclusive,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
I'm happy to break out of the Hogwarts thing, not being a big reader of the books.
Yeah.
I don't have any particular affection for the school,
mm-hmm.
and I'm happy to move away from the whole, you know, guest star teacher of the year thing
yeah.
and all of that aspect. I like now being in this position where this gigantic ensemble cast is
mm-hmm.
assembled, and you know, you get a few minutes with David Thewlis,
mm-hmm.
and you get some new people like Peter Mullen, who's
mm-hmm.
kind of, I guess, like, sort of like the Goebbels of this, you know, Voldemort magic regime.
Mm-hmm.
And he's awesome. He's
mm-hmm.
just, like, evil and just chomping and kind of menacing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so much fun. He's an actor I love anyway,
mm-hmm.
but he's a great addition to this cast. And I mean, it's like, at this point, any major British actor who isn't in the Harry Potter series has to feel kind of left out.
Yeah.
And a great deal of them who've been in the Harry Potter series are in this film. They all kind of
some
make
of them don't even
somewhere.
Have dialogue, but you'll see them like on a book jacket or, exactly, you know, right. or across a room. It's like, oh, it's the giant woman from the fourth movie, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. Oh, also, I like, you know, you mentioned, you know, there's not guest celebrity teacher of the year. Right. What I was impressed by is, I mean, I love Bill Nighy and I like Reese Fons, and they're both in the film, but like they each have like a scene,
right?
You know, whereas in before, if they had been in the movie, they probably would have like had a huge, like they would have been involved throughout. But the Deathly Hallows is not about
and Fons is kind of half unrecognizable. Like if you don't really realize that it's, if you don't know that it's him going in, it's easy to sit there through his whole sequence and be like, who the hell is that? You know, and he was good. He was like, that's a great part of the film. I really enjoyed that sequence a lot. He plays the father of the, you know, hippie,
Luna
weirdo
Lovegood.
Luna Lovegood, and does so very well.
Yeah. Well, should we kind of hit relatively quickly on the next 3 days and 127 hours to sort of, you know?
Yeah, let's do next 3 days real quick, and we can always do some Potter spoilers. So all right, so the next 3 days is the new film from writer-director Paul Haggis, who is famous for the worst Oscar Best Picture win in history for Crash, the crappy version of Crash, not the good David Cronenberg Crash. Yeah. But, you know, but Haggis, he was a TV writer, and then he wrote some of the Bond pictures, and he made In the Valley of Vela, which is a good movie. And so now, what's that?
I don't care for In the Valley of Vela, but...
Well, anyway. Yeah, we could. That's a subject for something else. So the next 3 days is stars Russell Crowe and Elizabeth Banks, and it's a remake of a French film called Pour Elle, a.k.a. Anything for Her. And basically the idea is that Russell Crowe plays a teacher, professor of some sort, and his wife, played by Elizabeth Banks, is arrested supposedly for murdering her boss, and is, despite protestations of innocence, is convicted and goes to jail, and he decides that he needs to break her out of jail. Mm-hmm. And so the movie is kind of a thriller, but it sort of subverts the whole idea of Russell Crowe as a movie star and of like the basic star-driven action picture, because Crowe's character is very much a schlubby regular guy, and so as he starts to go about trying to figure out how to get his wife out of jail, he realizes, I'm not really that good at this. This is hard.
He's way over his head.
It's really difficult.
Yeah.
And there's some cool things in the film where you, like, you know, there's a good deal of attention paid to how much money it's going to cost him to, you know, make this kind of, you know, under the table operation work.
Yeah, because not only does he want to get passports and things to like pay for if he even gets her out to like get her out of the country, what they're going to live on once they do that. And he's like, okay, if I cash out my 401k and sell my house, you know,
and do all this.
So the movies never pay attention to. You know,
right.
So.
And in that respect, it's pretty satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I liked Crowe. He's schlubby and sort of ineffective, but endearingly so, which is a great contrast to his kind of increasingly gruff public persona. Mm. I didn't buy Elizabeth Banks as much as the wife. Mm. There's a little sort of tangential possible love interest distraction played by Olivia Wilde, who's in the upcoming Tron Legacy, and she's fine, but she's in like three scenes. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. I mean, it's really Russell Crowe's movie, and he does a good job with it until the third act, which for me went off the rails and became kind of threw away a bunch of the you know, guidelines of the first two acts and suddenly becomes more of an action movie and ends with this resolution that I didn't really buy. But the first two-thirds of the movie I liked quite a bit.
I feel the third – I liked the movie a lot. Well, more than I thought I would. I'm not a fan of Paul Haggis. But I did like the fact that it's – you have a character who it's more interesting when you see someone fail and have to improvise on the spot, like when he tries to make a bump key. And it's like, who makes a bump key? And it's like, well, of course it's going to work on the first try. YouTube told me so.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and just seeing sort of those missteps. And
there are a lot of great scenes of him trying to figure out how to do stuff by watching videos that, like, high school kids made on YouTube, which I find really entertaining.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But and there's the just to jump on that, like, and if he gets caught for doing some of this stuff, he could go to jail and their son could have no parents. Exactly. So the stakes are really, they're really high.
You feel that, and that's yeah.
Yeah, and I think the film does a great job of the building the relationship between Crow and his son. Like, you definitely feel, to me, you feel a sense of time, even though the film is called The Next 3 Days, because he needs to get her out in 3 days before mm-hmm. she's transferred. The film actually goes back about three years.
Yeah.
And you sort of – the film, I think, does a good job of conveying, like, how time has passed and how the – and you lets you sort of fill in the relationships mm-hmm. of how, you know, Crow has kind of become – had to become closer with his mother and father because they have to become kind of caretakers mm-hmm. for his son when he's not around
yeah.
and sort of that life he's having to live. And to me, the third act works – I think it worked better for me than it did for Russ because, I don't know, when you see like he's doing 6 months of this planning, and when it becomes more of an action film, it's like, well, he's kind of been building to be an action, this action scene for 6 months. It's not like if the film had taken place over the course of 3 days and he's like, and now action scene.
Yeah,
and like
right.
he's totally unprepared and who is this guy? But I felt the film organically built to the fact where it's like, okay, now you can sort of have this action scene. The problem is when the film reaches the third act, it's been running pretty long by that point. The film
could
stand to be a 20 minutes shorter at least.
And there's even parts where it's like, okay, they've reached this emotional thing, and now, but now it's like, no, we're going to trail it out
right.
longer and longer. So, it's like, oh, I'm kind of losing what made me like it so much, half an hour ago,
Right.
Yeah. Actually, my problem was mostly in kind of the first 15 or so minutes when it felt very Paul Haggis-y and like right. excerpts from Crash. Like, one of the first scenes is like this argument over the dinner table, over like in a restaurant dinner party. And it's like, and it's weirdly like hostile. And they're like, these are related to each other, but they're like screaming at each other. And it's like, oh, this is just this is bullshit. I'm sorry.
I didn't understand.
This is just sort of trying to get us wound up because that's what he does,
Right. Yeah. And the scene Kurt is describing is Russell Crowe's character mm-hmm. and his brother mm-hmm. and their respective wives mm-hmm. at dinner. And it turns into this really vicious sort mm-hmm. of argument that doesn't seem to have any basis in anything,
mm-hmm.
but is, I guess, supposed to be predisposing us towards the notion that maybe Elizabeth Banks did kill her boss, mm-hmm. but it works really poorly. Mm-hmm. And you got to get over that hump.
Yeah.
And to me, it almost works against the idea of, these two characters. Crow loves his wife. Mm-hmm. And I've read other reviews sort of complaining, like, you don't really see it. So if you don't buy their love story, then why would you go for it? And I like the fact that the film just kind of backs off of it rather than mm-hmm. trying to go deep into showing us like how much they love each other mm-hmm. and, going into all that. They just sort of say they love each other. Let's hope the chemistry carries the day. It does to an extent. I don't think it as well as it could. But I think Crow's determination, because he believes it so much,
that's his
I
love
believed
for her.
It.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like I see his character's love for his wife throughout the whole movie because it's the omnipresent motivating factor. And I never even questioned that aspect.
And one thing I liked about Banks' performance and how they do the character is that since it kind of basically jumps 3 years from when she's arrested to her being mm-hmm. in jail and the appeal process being exhausted, she's she doesn't do this of, I'm innocent and you got to get me out of here. She's more like despairing and right. has like misdirected anger and stuff like that. So, it's
well, and she's dealing with the fact that like there's, Haggis does good things mm-hmm. with in the way he characterizes their son and, mm-hmm. and the son is completely brushing going on and is unwilling to accept it and all that sort of thing. There's a little too much stuff with the parents of Crow's character, who are played by Helen Carey and Brian Dennehy. And I was like, wait a second, you've got Brian Dennehy as a dad, and he's barely doing anything. Like, there's 4 scenes where there's like maybe, 4 or 5 sequences with the parents. Mm-hmm. And the first 4 of them, he doesn't even have a line. I'm like, what the hell? You've got Dennehy. But then he does have a good emotional payoff. He's kind of like one of the film's sort of big emotional hinge points. It definitely involves Dennehy, and he's completely understated, and he does it really well, and I liked that. But yeah, I just give the guy another line. He just seems like movable set dressing right now, which is too bad.
Well, this film is like a lot of like just walk on the movie. You know, you
got like Olivia Wilde for three scenes, Brian Denny for
Liam
four.
Liam Neeson for one scene.
Yeah. Working half a day on set.
He's great, though.
And, oh, it's a fantastic scene. You have the RZA, you have Kevin Corrigan.
Yeah. Daniel Stern as a lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun appearance, you know. So.
Right. Yeah, the RZA was great in his little thing. Yeah, Kevin Corrigan, always happy to see him. And he's got good. Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of like, hey, I'm Paul Haggis. I know famous people.
Yeah.
Right. Why don't you show up? And yeah. And it's in a way, it's almost distracting because like I see the RZA and I expect that, oh, so this character is going to be a more major. Significant in this way.
No.
Not so much. Yeah. Not really. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we hit that. So why don't we do 127 hours then, unless someone wants to say anything else about the next 3 days.
No, I mean, yeah. I think we covered it.
Yeah. Well, 127 Hours opened in other places in the country a few weeks ago, and so probably everyone knows what happens in it. I don't know if we should just – maybe should we dance around what
it's
the
a
ending
true
of the movie?
Story.
Yeah.
I think that it's – you
yeah,
know.
That happened in 2003. Yeah.
It's being made because
well
of
– publicized. Yeah. Right. I think it's fine.
Okay. But –
James anyway, Franco is a ghost.
Yeah, James Franco plays Aaron Ralston, who's kind of a I believe he's some kind of engineer during the week, but on the weekend he's sort of a Mountain Dew commercial fish listening guy who goes out on his own to do the kind of the outdoor extreme activities thing, you know, and he's very fun, but he's like kind of impulsive and not responsible.
Kind of a dick.
Yeah, and but friendly and nice, you know.
Yeah, but arrogant and you know, really believes far more in his own capabilities than anything else.
Yeah, and funny, it's like, he ends up getting his arm stuck in – he gets it stuck in a crevice with his arm under this boulder.
Right.
And it's like, oops, how am I going to get out of this boulder? And he's got some electronic gizmos with him, but nothing that can call anyone. And
no lasers.
No one knows where he is, you know. So it's almost like it reminded me a little bit of Castaway, the Tom Hanks movie, where it's like you've got a normal person stranded with just kind of these objects, and it's like, how is he going to live? And he actually does some pretty clever things with the stuff he's got to like try maybe, you know, make a pulley system to lift the rock, but it doesn't work. And so he has to kind of think about the traditional method of escape that coyotes use when they're caught in traps, basically. Yeah. You know,
reminded coyotes and their multi-tools.
Yeah.
In that respect, it reminded me more of watching the Paul Haggis version of Crash, where Crash is the boulder. And I wanted to chew my own arm off to get away from the movie.
Yeah.
In the movie, I mean, 127 Hours is kind of it's an interesting experiment because it's almost Hitchcockian in a sense, you know, in the way that like Hitchcock tried to do Rope, which was, you know, famously a fake one take movie. And in this case, it's a one man show from James Franco, basically. I mean, he's 75% of the film. He's the only guy on screen. And he has some tools at his disposal. He has a video camera with, you know, that he uses to record these kind of little video diaries. And
the video camera is like the volleyball in Castaway.
Exactly,
it gives us something to talk to.
Gives it, right, yeah. And it gives us an alternate way to see the world around him and to see Ralston. And, you know, the film is directed by Danny Boyle, who did Trainspotting and Slumdog Millionaire. And he had two cinematographers shoot the film. And there's a lot of very distinct and energetic visual storytelling going on where he's breaking the screen up into multiple panels. He's, you know, like doing really dramatic shifts in color. The movie opens with this super saturated, like, it looks like Tony Scott's stuff in Unstoppable, you know, where it's just like the colors are bleeding into each other. They're so intense. And then as the movie goes on and Ralston is stuck in the crevice, the color kind of drains out of the movie. And the pace of the movie, the visual, the frenetic visual cutting and montage of imagery sort of slows down and then ramps back up again. And some of his tricks in the visual storytelling to me were a little distracting, a little much, like he's putting the camera in the water bottle and things like that. And it's like, I don't need to look up into James Franco's mouth as he's, you know, trying to get the last of the water. It's just like, that doesn't really communicate the story to me you know, and you're already doing a lot to visually break it up and make it interesting.
To me, that stuff worked because the whole film is trying about being about life and being vivacious, and by constantly keeping the camera moving and putting it in an odd place, it's like we can go anywhere and do anything, and it's like you could be in a water bottle, you could be under a thing, you could be anywhere, yeah. And it's like, you know. So to me, the cinematography worked on that level, where it's just, you know, I'm alive!
Even though I'm stuck.
Even though I'm stuck.
But I think Franco is really good at getting that across. His performance is great. His performance is fierce and energetic and very lively. And you really, like, you know, kind of in the same way as you've got Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network, it's like, I don't really know what the line is between truth and fiction here as this goes as being a portrayal of a real person.
Although Ralston was involved with this film.
But what I'm – my point is just that, like, he plays a very convincing character. And this version of Aaron Ralston, whatever relationship it has to the real one, feels very whole and very real and very believable to me. And James Franco is great. I mean, it's all him.
Yeah.
And that's – I would rather just see – more of him acting than some of the camera tricks.
But we should say that there are flashbacks and kind of dream scenes where they show other characters. But one of the kind of neat things is they don't like use those to establish these kind of bogus relationships, where it's like this one flashback with this issue with my mother, and another one will kind of tie it up in a thing. So it doesn't go that way. And the fact that they're kind of short, it kind of implies that he's got almost like superficial relationships with people, which is kind of his problem, that the film sort of teaches him a pretty serious lesson and not to be that way in the future.
Right. I think one of the things I really like in terms of cinematography with those scenes is, you know, it's like from his point of view, but then we see sort of a silhouette as if he's looking in on his own life, but he's not a part of it anymore.
Yeah, it's very Capra, you know. Yeah. It's a Wonderful Life.
And supposedly James Franco wasn't there for when they shot those scenes. They had someone else be kind of looking over his shoulder thing.
Okay.
To kind of emphasize the isolation thing,
right.
I guess.
You know? Yeah, I mean, the flashbacks and the dream sequences work really well, and they're not too indulgent. They give us, I think, just as much of what we need. It's just some of the distracting visual style. Mm-hmm. Danny Boyle, not a subtle filmmaker. Yeah. And this is not a subtle film. I mean, it's about a very big, dramatic, you know, thing that happened to one person, and that by and large that's communicated very, very well. But there's places where he just, in his efforts to keep it visually interesting, he just goes a little, you know, he goes a little over the top, and I can't quite blame him for that. But
he has to keep it interesting, and Franco has to keep it interesting, not only because can they not physically go anywhere, but because you know where 127 Hours is going if you know Ralston's story.
Right.
You know that, and I think we can spoil it. He cuts his own arm off.
Yeah.
You know, with a multi-tool. And that scene is, you know, it's been reported that people have been fainting and, you know, just unable to handle it. I thought it was graphic, but not in a way that made me turn away.
It's very elliptical, and it cuts away a lot. So it'll, like, show us, like, okay, here's where he is now. here's how far he is cutting through it. But it doesn't, it's not like, I watched the movie Audition recently. With a very graphic and harrowing dismembering scene in it, and this is nothing like that, or one of the films that would be like that. So
there were a lot of other aspects of the film that were much more sort of tense and harrowing to me than the actual act of him, you know, performing auto surgery. And I mean, that sequence is done very well, but that to me wasn't even it's almost, you know, the stuff for me that was worse was kind of earlier on when he's realizing exactly what his predicament is. And it's this sort of thing where, like, you know, you kind of see, we get to see how we, you know, the whole fact of the movie is that he's overconfident, but you can see also that there's a reason for him to be overconfident, because he kind of almost knows, you know, he basically knows what he's doing, and he's not as well prepared as he should be, but he's pretty prepared. And, you know, it's like he's stuck in this crevasse, and the boulder isn't just pinning his arm. It's holding him. It's not even just that. It's holding him up. He's not standing on the ground. You know, it's like his feet are not on the ground. He's kind of like, his feet are like on rocky perches, but but he has to tie himself to the boulder so that as he's passing out, he's kind of supported and not just falling back, and putting stress on the arm and things like that. And there's a lot of stuff there that's really well communicated visually, I think, and that shows not just his situation, but his character and who he was and the nature of his personality and then, you know, what he has to do to overcome those things that are both strengths and limitations for him.
Right.
Okay. Well, why don't we, now that we've spoiled 127 hours, we can spoil Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 a little bit.
Part 1.
Well, in Part 2, I'll spoil that, too.
Everybody dies. <Yeah. laughs> okay, well, I guess you guys are looking at me because I had problems with 2 points. So there's the end of Deathly Hallows Part 1. Harry and Hermione have split away from Ron. There's been an argument, and they're trying to find this one of the Horcruxes. They're trying to find a sword that can destroy the Horcruxes.
Yeah. And I didn't mention that, you know, that magical object, MacGuffin exactly. before in my list of them. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a point where they're kind of almost. It's almost like Krull, where the fortress and Krull teleports to a random place each day. Like they're kind of randomly flitting about the countryside, magically teleporting so that Voldemort's people can't follow them. And they've ended up at this point, and Harry is sort of, they're camped in the woods, and Harry's sort of led out of the wood, led to this other part of the woods by this light, you know, and just kind of finds the sword that they're looking for in this pool.
And I think it's explained in the second part how the sword got there. Yeah. Like, they briefly, she's like, why isn't this in my, like, Helena Bonham Carter's character is like, why isn't this in my safe? You know, why is the sword here? Yeah. And so I assume they explain in the second movie. I can't remember why the sword is at the bottom.
I remember why it's in there, because when a character puts it there and uses his own Patronus, which is what we see in the film, to lead them there.
Right.
But we don't know who that is.
And the first film doesn't reveal it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it just feels like, and then not only that, but then Ron reappears there as well. So it's like, wait a second, you just happened to find the sword in the middle of nowhere in this place to which you randomly appeared, and Ron showed up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so that's Deus Ex Machina number one. Mm-hmm. Is like
Ron showing up didn't bother me because like they had set it up, the fact like he has this special deluminator which will guide him back, and it's sort of like Dumbledore knew that Ron would, you know, try to get out of it, I didn't think that
particular device was really had been revealed that it would guide him back to them.
That's true. It doesn't really explain.
You don't know that.
That the Deluminator also has the ability to do this.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so
Quasi Machina.
Like, exactly. So that was number one, and that really just kind of like the movie had been really kind of perfectly spellbinding up until that point, and then I was just like, what? Yeah. Wait, these things just came together. How? Why? And then there's another point later on. So the whole movie going on, Harry's had this chunk of glass or a mirror, which you kind of see somebody reflected in. And I was thinking it was Sirius Black, but I guess it's Dumbledore. And
I'm pretty sure it's Dumbledore.
It is Dumbledore, yeah. And he's sort of looking into it, and he's having these visions of what Voldemort is doing, etc. And there's this point where he and Ron and Hermione have been sort of taken by the show, et cetera. And they're sort of trapped, and they're, you know, and Harry basically uses the mirror, I guess, to call Dobby house elf.
I believe that's a chunk of the mirror of Erised, which is the mirror he sees in the first film that shows you your heart's desire. I don't know how it got it must have gotten broken in the last movie or something like that.
Right.
But I think
I don't think that's the mirror. Like, the mirror is like he was given a handheld mirror by Sirius Black. It's like, just show you where anyone is ever. Like, you look like there are too many mirrors, goddamn.
It's very unclear.
I don't remember that. I thought he was like hoping that Dumbledore could somehow communicate to him what to do.
Right.
And that Dobby's arrival was lucky.
Right. So anyway, those are the 2 points where those two things really kind of snapped me out of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the finding of the sword and the arrival of Ron is one, mm-hmm. and then the arrival of Dobby, who kind of gets them out of everything, as the other.
Although the ending of that scene is played really well. I think it sort of finds its footing again because.
No question. Mm-hmm.
You know, which is surprising because Dobby is a really irritating character.
Yeah.
And
much better digitally rendered this time. The house elves look a lot better this time. Yeah. They had in the past.
I was actually not impressed with a lot of the CGI in it. That seemed kind of obvious to me. And like some of like the stuff with like the twins, maybe just because we'd seen, you know, The Social Network soon, which is right, like, you know, perfect, you know. Yeah. So
now actual twins is disarming.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, when they're like, you know.
Oh, when they take the poly?
Yeah, when they're like looking like Harry Potter and stuff. Oh, okay. Like that. So, So
that's a great scene, though. Yeah, that's like, to me, that's another thing. It's like, oh, you know, people are coming to kill us, but now we can have a really funny scene where, like, we'll dress Daniel Radcliffe in dresses. And
yeah, that was like one of those scenes of funny magic.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. Yeah. There's actually, I'll say, this, I don't know if this counts as a spoiler, but a scene that I like in the book a lot, I wouldn't say it was one of my favorites, but there's a moment when basically Harry says goodbye to the Dursleys, which is like aunt and uncle, which are, you know, basically been like jerks to him all his life, you know. And they're leaving. There's a part where his like cousin Dudley is like, "Well, wait, Harry's not coming with us," you know. And
they shake hands.
And they shake hands, and he's like, "See you later, Harry." Mm-hmm. So it's like another nice little grace moment. That's like, he's not so bad on that level after all.
I wish they had included that. And another thing I did have a problem with is that Timothy Spall's character Wormtail, mm-hmm. in the book, it makes it very clear that he is like. Because Harry spared his life back in the third movie, rather than kill him, something happened where Wormtail basically kills himself. He can't hurt Harry, and his silver arm kills himself. And in the movie, it's very unclear if he's even dead. Like, his wand basically backfires, and you see, like, this spurt of blood, and he falls down. But, like, it's, like,
maybe that'll happen.
It's not really played.
In the book,
that's where he dies.
Yeah.
But I don't know if, like, will he be in the second movie? Yeah, like, it was a death that was played very oddly.
Mm-hmm. Right. We could probably go on and on, but I will say I really like how the Malfoy family was reacting to all the Voldemort stuff, because it's like they're like the cool kind of Aryan aristocratic villains who most of the film, and now like Voldemort's in charge and they're freaked out. Yeah. I mean, they're like, oh, this is just awful.
They're like, this isn't the future we imagined. This is you know, this isn't how we thought this was gonna work. It's played really, really well by everyone involved there. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of very strong little kind of character stuff that all works in the movie's favor.
Yeah, it's like hitching our star to this noseless psychopath probably wasn't such a good idea, you know. So.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, I guess do we have a release date for Deathly Hallows 2? It's
July 15th.
July 15th. Well, okay, so we'll have to, you know, sit tight until then. And until then, my name is Kurt Holman again, and I write for Creative Loafing, and I tweet in their name Kurt_Holman.
I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and I'm on Twitter at Twitter.com/RussFisher.
And I'll thank once again Alejandro Leal for listening to all of this and having us spoil the various movies for him all up and down, you know, and making everything sound good. And thanks for listening all the way through to the end.